Ani, and welcome to Bomsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasagay. The Métis Centre of the National Aboriginal Health Organization and Métis Nation of British Columbia have launched resources for women at risk of sexual exploitation. Oil pipeline projects haven't been winning any popularity contests. A Gitxsan Hereditary Chief talks about the nation's opposition to the proposed Northern Gateway Pipeline, and south of the border, the proposed Keystone XL Pipeline isn't gaining points there either. A University of Manitoba researcher suggests how living conditions can be improved in Northern Aboriginal communities. Plus, plans are in the works for Habitat for Humanity housing projects in selected First Nations across the country. All these stories, plus great tunes, all coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. Attawapiskat had been the hot topic again this week. During a special meeting of the Assembly of First Nations in Ottawa, a group of chiefs marched to the steps of Parliament. APTN reports the chiefs rallied around Attawapiskat as calls were issued for oil pipeline blockades in three provinces. Attawapiskat First Nation Chief Teresa Spence told the Assembly it was time to take a stronger stance against the federal government. She also urged chiefs to have a plan in place for the meeting with Prime Minister Stephen Harper in late January. A federally appointed accountant was turned away by Attawapiskat when he arrived in the community to conduct his duties as appointed by the federal government while the First Nation is in third-party management. The Northwestern Ontario community is in the throes of a housing crisis, is facing poverty and related social issues. Since the chief declared a state of emergency for Attawapiskat in the beginning of November, the National Post reports the federal government has recently given the First Nation an ultimatum: work with the third-party manager to retrofit existing facilities or evacuate needy residents until homes are built. Ottawa has also promised to send the community 15 homes and has committed $500,000 as per a request from the chief. Meanwhile, it has been found out that Attawapiskat has to foot the bill for the third-party manager to the tune of $1,300 a day, totaling to about $180,000 until the appointee has completed the financial work by the end of June. The story of Attawapiskat is becoming a familiar one as a northern Manitoba First Nation. Wasagamuk is in much the same boat. According to CBC, residents there are also living in shacks, using slop pails as toilets, living with poverty, lack running water, and have poor housing. Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development told CBC it had sent the community $10 million over the past 10 years for housing and infrastructure, but leadership says it costs about $150,000 to replace inadequate houses. The community relies on winter roads to bring in supplies or an expensive helicopter ride over the warmer months of the year. And just south of that community lies Lake St. Martin. But band members there have been living in Winnipeg hotel rooms since spring when the community was severely damaged by flooding. CBC News reports the province laid out a $40 million plan to convert an old military base into a temporary community for Lake St. Martin members. Community leadership had originally supported that plan, but withdrew support after it learned the province wouldn't use band-owned businesses to set up the temporary village. So now, community members are divided on the issue of whether or not to support the temporary village idea or support Lake St. Martin leadership. A University of Manitoba researcher says northern communities need to focus on sustainability to help avoid current situations. Shirley Thompson is an associate professor at the University of Manitoba with the Natural Resource Institute. She's been looking into how the delivery of essential services, including water, housing, waste management, and food security, can be improved in northern communities. Thompson has also been working collaboratively with Lake St. Martin First Nation on a community sustainability model for the permanent relocation. Thompson says Lake St. Martin is developing its community land use plan around natural resources, which is important for communities to do.
We are looking at a planned community that includes sustainable food production and energy production in its plan, in its land use plan. So I think it's very important to look at the natural resources available to the communities, do a natural resource assessment, and then look at how community economic development can be used to create jobs and housing and sustainable community that meets the needs of the community.
She adds energy projects such as geothermal and biomass can also boost the local economy by providing jobs. Statistics Canada has projected that the Aboriginal population could number between 1.7 to 2.2 million by 2031. CBC reports Saskatchewan will be home to the highest population of Aboriginal people, making up 24% of the population in that province. The census also predicts that the majority of the Aboriginal population, about 36%, will reside in metropolitan areas. In about two decades, the report indicates cities such as Thunder Bay, Sudbury, Winnipeg, Regina, and Saskatoon will see Aboriginal people making up 10% of their populations, and by 2031, the median age for Aboriginal population will be about 36 years old, up from the current median of 26.6 years old. Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development has introduced new legislation to change rules on First Nations elections. CN News reports the First Nations Elections Act will extend the length of the term of office for chiefs and band councillors from 2 years to four. John Duncan, Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, says the change will create more stability on reserves. Duncan also said the change is First Nations driven. Media reports the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs wanted reforms to the Indian Act system. First Nations will be able to opt into the proposed legislation. And in the resource sector, proposed oil pipeline projects haven't been gaining any more points with First Nations. Recently, there was a press release from the Gitxsan Treaty Office in northwestern BC. The chief negotiator there and hereditary chief Elmer Derrick announced a $1.7 million deal with Enbridge. But that was all bunk, according to Gitxsan hereditary chief Norman Stevens. He says Derrick didn't have the authority to make that deal because the Gitxsan stood in solidarity with the other 60 First Nations opposed to the Northern Gateway Pipeline. Stevens says the clans met following the announcement from Derrick and decided to voice their disagreement with the announcement, plus demand that the negotiators with the treaty office step down. Stevens thinks the oil company is using Derrick.
I'm pretty sure the only purpose of that announcement was to try to reduce the effect of the declaration from the day before from the 61 Nations. They seem to be using Elmer. He was not doing the witches of the Gitxsan Nation. He was working for Elmer and the Gitxsan Treaty Society solely.
Stephen says the Gitxsan Nation will be sending a letter to Enbridge declaring the $1.7 million deal null and void. The treaty office has been boarded up and Elmer Derrick has been unavailable for comment. South of the border, the proposed Keystone XL pipeline hasn't won any First Nations from Native American leadership there. Marty Cobanez is with the Indigenous Environmental Network in the U.S. He says Native American leaders recently met with U.S. President Obama and urged him to reject a permit for the proposed pipeline. The pipeline is proposed to run from northeastern Alberta to multiple destinations in the U.S., including Illinois. Cobanez says Native American leaders gave Obama their Mother Earth Accord, signed by Native American leadership and environmental and farming groups. Besides environmental concerns, Cobanez says the proposed pipelines aren't feasible long-term projects.
If the Keystone and the Northern Gateway line were to be built, it would take until 2030 for them to even have capacity to fill them completely at all times. So, I mean, this is a long-term project that we're looking at and saying no now because they're not going to need it later in the future.
Last month, the Obama administration decided to delay the approval for the pipeline, and Indian Country Today reports the delay is expected to last until next year after the presidential election. Selected First Nations across the country could soon be welcoming new homes through the Habitat for Humanity program. Recently, Habitat for Humanity and the Assembly of First Nations have joined forces to enhance housing on reserves. Stuart Hardacre, president and CEO of Habitat for Humanity, says the organization has been running an Aboriginal housing pilot program for about 4 years, and he says they hope to build about 100 homes in selected First Nations throughout the country.
Our target right now is to have over 100 homes for Aboriginal families over the next 5 years. I know it's might not sound like a big number relative to the need, but what's important about Habitat always is that it's about the permanent change and the transformational impact that homeowners can have with, in terms of both economic, but in terms of family health and in terms of the dignity of the family and all the other things that Habitat homeowners enjoy or are able to achieve once they receive their homes.
Future homeowners participating in the Habitat program are required to put in 500 hours of sweat equity into the building of their new homes. The Métis Center of the National Aboriginal Health Organization and Métis Nation of British Columbia have launched resources for women at risk of sexual exploitation. Victoria Pruden is Director of Children and Families, Women and Elders for the Métis Nation in BC. She says the resources are simple.
Some of the products are very, very impactful, very simple, but they provide a lot of impact, and it's something that is great for Métis women as well as service providers.
Pruden says the new resources for Métis women came out of research, and Métis women identify the need for Métis-specific resource tools. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
At the head of the creek, and I'm going up to see her about two times a week. Kiss her in the mouth, sweet as any wine. Wrap herself around me like a sweet tater vine. I'm going up Cripple Creek, going in a run. Going up Cripple Creek to have a little fun. Going up Cripple Creek, going in a whirl. Going up Cripple Creek to see my little girl. Now the girls up at Cripple Creek about half grown. Jump on a boy like a dog on a bone. Roll my britches up to my knees. Wait, oh Cripple Creek, never I please. I'm going up Cripple Creek, going in the run. Going up Cripple Creek to have a little fun. Going up Cripple Creek, going in the world. Going up Cripple Creek to see my little girl. Creek's wide and the Cripple Creek's deep. I'll wait, oh Cripple Creek, before I sleep. Hills are steep and the roads are muddy, and I'm so dizzy that I can't stand steady. I'm going up Cripple Creek, going in a run. Going up Cripple Creek to have a little fun. Going up Cripple Creek, going in the world. Going up Cripple Creek to see my girl.
That was Cripple Creek from Buffy St. Marie. Research has revealed that Métis women want culturally specific services for sexual assault issues, and the Métis Center of the National Aboriginal Health Organization and Métis Nation of British Columbia have launched resources for women at risk of sexual exploitation. Victoria Pruden, Director of Children and Families, Women and Elders for the Métis Nation in BC, and Catherine Graham is the Director of the Métis Center of the National Aboriginal Health Organization, and they spoke with Bombsida, and here is some of our conversation.
When we came up with the idea for this project, the Métis Centre at National Aboriginal Health has partnered with Métis Nation British Columbia on a number of projects, and some of them have had to do with healthy families, healthy children, traditional parenting, support for youth in their identity. And we hadn't done a specific women's project on this topic yet, so we thought it was an excellent opportunity, sort of given that a lot of the research that's been done about sexual exploitation of Aboriginal women hasn't had any Métis-specific content. We felt that this could be a really important place for us to start. So I'm just going to run through some of the objectives of the research here. One of the objectives was to identify and examine the vulnerabilities and resilience of Métis women to sexual exploitation, including the role of Métis culture and identity. And when the research findings were analyzed and presented, identity is a key piece. We also wanted to understand the nature of supports and services available to and used by Métis women, including opportunities and barriers. One of the next steps that we have is definitely working with existing service providers, but also this supports us in lobbying for more Métis-specific services available to Métis women and their families in the province. And the third objective was to design Métis-specific health promotion messaging products that address issues relating to Métis women at risk of sexual exploitation. And some of the products are very, very impactful, very simple, but they provide a lot of impact, and it's something that is great for Métis women as well as service providers.
So I'm going to interrupt you. And so how different were the research findings, or how different was the research that's been done for Métis-specific issues on sexual exploitation than First Nations or the pan-Aboriginal approach?
And I'm gonna just pass the phone over to Kathy for comment on that.
As Victoria indicated, to our knowledge, there hasn't been any Métis-specific research done in the area of sexual exploitation. And through the previous work that we've done, some of it with MMBC, we found that the needs of Métis are very different than those of First Nations and non-Aboriginal individuals, because while there is a collective history, I suppose, and you know, the historical experiences can be somewhat similar, they're also very different. And the Métis women that we spoke to for the purpose of this project expressed feelings of social exclusion. And that exclusion occurred not only at the hands of non-Aboriginal individuals and services and groups, but also they felt excluded by First Nations. And as a result, you know, we found that a lot of Métis women, or some of the Métis women that we spoke to anyway, didn't disclose their Métis identity. And we know through other research that we've done that identity is an overarching social determinant of health. In fact, the World Health Organization, I believe, and the Public Health Agency of Canada indicates that culture is a social determinant of health. And experiencing that loss of culture and identity for Métis is very, very current, and it's very, very significant. And trying to find services that will incorporate the need to reclaim identity is key in ensuring that the holistic, or the complete needs of Métis individuals are met.
That was Victoria Proop, Director of Children and Families, Women and Elders for the Métis Nation in BC, and Catherine Graham, Director of the Métis Centre of the National Aboriginal Health Organization. Oil pipeline projects haven't been winning any popularity contests on both sides of the border, and recently there was a press release from the Gitxsan Treaty Office in northwestern BC. The chief negotiator there and Hereditary Chief Elmer Derrick announced a $1.7 million deal with Enbridge. But that was all bunk, according to Gitxsan Hereditary Chief Norman Stevens.
We'll start with the announcement that came out on Friday. The Hereditary Chiefs were not aware that Elmer was actually negotiating with Enbridge. And we weren't prepared to hear an announcement of an agreement with Enbridge. We most certainly were not in approval of any agreement with Enbridge. Since that time, the chiefs have met, the three clans have met on Sunday, and they had unanimously decided that the action should be taken. They should voice their disapproval with the Enbridge agreement, but also that the three negotiators, Elmer Derrick, Bev Clifton Percival, and Gordon Sebastian, the executive director, should be terminated immediately, and that the Gitxsan Treaty Society office should be closed. After the Klan meetings on Sunday, there was an all-Klans meeting held later that evening to reaffirm it and make a plan of action. And what came from that meeting is that we would take this action on Monday. So we met Monday morning, had some discussion on it, and reaffirmed that this was the action that we had to take. And from that meeting, we did a walk to the Gippsland Treaty Society building, and there the hereditary chiefs informed Gordon Sebastian and Bev Clifton. Elmer Derrick was unfortunately out of town at the time, and we informed him, or the hereditary chiefs informed him, that their services were no longer needed, and they were terminated immediately. And the Gippsland Treaty Society office was to be closed.
So did Elmer Derrick have authority to do that?
No, he was hired as the chief negotiator for negotiating a treaty. He was not authorized at all to do any negotiating with Enbridge. They had, at one time, signed a document, I believe. I didn't sign that document, but where they said they would talk with Enbridge, exchange in dialogue, but nothing that said they would negotiate a deal. And even there, prior to that announcement, if he was negotiating a deal, it should have been made aware to the hereditary chiefs that he claims to represent.
So is the treaty office closed? Because I was speaking with somebody else just earlier, and they said that the treaty office has been boarded up.
Yes, it is boarded up, and there is the security outside being sure to protect the building and protect the data inside. We have sensitive data, computers and such. We've terminated the employees, and we can't have any of that data being destroyed. That's why it's been boarded up. They refused to hand over the keys, and we're still waiting for those keys.
And so getting back to the opposition to the Northern Gateway, and that's been ongoing for some time, right?
There were a number of nations that announced solidarity in opposition to the pipeline on Thursday. They made it really clear that they were opposed to the pipeline, and they would do anything they could to stop the pipeline. Interesting to note that Enbridge brings out Elmer on Friday and announces a deal with the Gitsan. I'm pretty sure the only purpose of that announcement was to try to reduce the effect of the declaration from the day before from the 61 nations. They seem to be using Elmer. He was not doing the wishes of the Gitsan nation. He was working for Elmer and the Gitsan Treaty Society solely. Of course, because of that, he's been removed.
So do you think that Enbridge is going to call that consultation?
Well, I really don't know what they're going to do with that. But a letter will be sent to him declaring the deal null and void. Even if, as far as the Gitsan are concerned, there should be no pipeline going through here. We have our resources to protect. And if we look at this deal, it's $7 million over 30 years. It is so minuscule, it's laughable. Because if you take that and divide it up by the amount of years, you come up with some $233,000 per year for the Gitsan. Now, if you take the 10,000 Gitsan, that's at a midpoint between what Enbridge has, some 13,000, and other numbers that are in the range of 6,000. But if you use the number 10,000, that amounts to being a mere $23 per each Gitsan. Now, somehow, Elmer feels it's right to make a deal like this, on claiming on behalf of the Gitsan Hereditary Chiefs, a deal that is so laughable, it's just mind-boggling. He has to have had other reasons for making the announcement. And is it a panic announcement that because of the declaration by the other nations the day before? It just does not fit well with the Gitsan. You don't put your resources on the line for a mere $23 per Gitsan. You can't risk your fish for that amount of money. can't risk your fish for any amount of money.
That was Gippsland Hereditary Chief Norman Stevens. After this song, we'll get the dibs on another controversial proposed pipeline project south of the border. But here's Digging speak. Roots with Rebel, a cut from their CD Seeds.
Your language, when you don't think, in your mind is messed up. Oh, when you're down, when you're down, rebel against violence, rebel. Bury the book in the regression. Raise our voices, let our stories be told. We shall be heard. We shall be heard.
We shall be heard.
Rebuild. When it's all you see, living in this crisis, when you release from their vices, now we let your truth be told. Speak up, and let your truth be known. Speak up, and let your truth be told. Oh, when our leaders are blinded, they shall be reminded. We will not be misunderstood, alienated, nor divided. No more hegemonic guilt confided. I said we are in review. Our principles demand the truth to follow suit in this movement of non-abuse. Historical misrepresentation, manipulation, and perpetration. That's leading us in the direction of a mass assimilation. What's the boom? It's legal. Our kids were kicked off and missed us to school. So we rebuild our own education. No more emotional or physical or mental incarceration. We rebel out of spiritual love and self-respect. And I attest to seeing this real revolution where the people stand holding babies in hands. Singing our knowledge is the foundation of our roots. And there is no time in us like to hold on to a few. So creation will change like it always has. From the songs of our ancestors and the voice of this land. From the songs of our ancestors and the voice of this land. So stand up and fight. This is our land and we know our rights. So stand up and fight. This is our land and we know our rights. And rebel, rebel. Now I said rebel. From this warring system I said rebel. We've been tied down. Stand up and rebel. Rebel, rebel. Now I said rebel. Rebel.
the border, the proposed Keystone XL pipeline hasn't won any favors from Native American leadership. Marty Cobanese is with the Indigenous Environmental Network in the U.S.
President Obama invited all the 565 tribal nations in the U.S. They're chairman to the White House for a summit, which he has for the last 3 years. We looked at it as our chance to get our tribal leaders in who are opposed to the Keystone XL pipeline to have a word with President Obama and to hand him the Mother Earth Accord that was created by tribal leaders and IEN and other and landowners in Dakota and Nebraska. Basically opposing tar sands, Keystone XL, the hell, and for many different reasons, the Ogallala Aquifer, the damages that it's doing in Canada, Aboriginal First Nations people, to violating treaty rights in both the U.S. and Canada. So it's a strong accord that we have that was created, and that was personally to President Obama by Rosebud President Rodney Bordeaux, to which President Bordeaux was one of the authors of the Mother Earth Accord also.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know a lot of other First Nations around the BC area who are opposing the Enbridge pipeline say that, you know, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, considering what happened in the Gulf of Mexico.
That's still going to happen. Well, look at Kalamazoo, Michigan, the Bolson River earlier this year, also even one the other day that was spilling down in, I forget where that was spilling at, in Denver, there's an oil pipeline that leaked in Denver also, and all of those are tar sands oil. They don't know exactly how to clean up tar sands oil yet out of river systems and water. Obviously, with Kalamazoo, Michigan, they spent $600 million on the cleanup, and oil is still at the bottom of the river.
Mm.
Tar sands is not like conventional crude oil, obviously, in that it doesn't float to the surface like conventional crude oil. The tar sands actually sinks to the bottom, so it creates a whole new atmosphere for them to even try and figure out how to clean it up now.
And can you tell us a little bit about the Mother Earth Accord?
Yeah, just briefly what I already talked about. It's a binational accord between U.S. and Canada tribes. It's designed by several tribes on both sides of the borders, signed by several hundred citizens and environmental groups on both sides of the border. And it's really is to show the unity in this fight, in that it's not just indigenous people, it's not just farmers, it's not just ranchers, not landowners. It's everybody is in this together, and that we're fighting the tar sands. That we don't want the tar sands in at all. It's very corrosive. It's going to create lots of environmental issues when there's a leak, and it's also going to create a lot of environmental issues affecting it. Even if they start saying they're going to start using the SAGD or the in situ, still going to be, I compare in situ to fracking in the United States. They're pushing down into the ground, and it's going to cause even longer term effects to the people in the entire region up there. But it's really, and it's even getting the heavy haul out in Montana and Idaho region involved. And because what we're saying is that if they can bring the heavy haul equipment up to Canada, to the Kuril mines, that they can then expand the tar sands. If they can't expand the tar sands, they don't need the Keystone XL pipeline, the Northern Gateway pipeline, because they don't have the capacity to fill them, which they don't have right now already. If the Keystone and the Northern Gateway pipeline were to be built, it would take until 2030 for them to even have capacity to fill them completely at all times. So, I mean, this is a long-term project that we're looking at and saying no now, because they're not going to need it later in the future. So, but, you know, this is what it really is, unifying document, showing that all of us are in this together, we're supporting each other, and that we're fighting this together instead of the usual and conquer technique that goes on.
That was Marty Cobenais, who is with the Indigenous Environmental Network in the U.S. Selected First Nations across the country could soon be welcoming new homes through the Habitat for Humanity program. Recently, Habitat for Humanity and the Assembly of First Nations joined forces to enhance housing on reserves. Stuart Hardager is the president and CEO of Habitat for Humanity.
It's a new partnership that we've signed with National Chief Atlio and the Assembly of First Nations. Habitat had an Aboriginal housing program for a number of years, actually since 2007. We know that in terms of the affordable housing issue in Canada, well, it's prevalent in every community and across the country. It's particularly pervasive within the Aboriginal community, and as the circumstances in Attawapiskat have so clearly demonstrated to Canadians, it's a severe and critical issue in Aboriginal communities, and we want to do our part to help address the issue.
And so I know you mentioned that this is not a response to recent headlines and Attawapiskat being the biggest issue in national headlines for the past couple of weeks now. But would a community like Attawapiskat be under consideration, and what kind of challenges would that pose, because it takes a lot of money or other kind of work to get supplies actually there?
Yeah, we do build now in what can be remote communities that don't have access throughout the year. For example, Habitats act in all 10 provinces, coast to coast to coast, and we actually have the most northernest Habitat affiliate within Habitat globally, and that's in Iqaluit, Nunavut. And certainly their challenge with regard to some of the similar logistical circumstances of getting supplies in for building. And so that would be true certainly of any remote community. Our biggest challenge, I suppose, that we need to find way to address is the fact that Habitat Canada itself doesn't build. It's our local affiliates, and we have over 70 of those across Canada. It's their capacity and their ability to support build in remote communities. And Attawapiskat is about 1,000 kilometers from our nearest affiliate in Thunder Bay. And so there certainly is a challenge there. We're not an emergency aid or emergency housing agency or charity. We're about long-term, sustainable, permanent housing solutions. And we think that needs to be brought to the table for the benefit of Aboriginal communities and families, just as the situation in Attawapiskat needs emergency response as well, that some agencies like the Red Cross are responding to. So I don't want to suggest that we're a type of organization that can respond to the critical issue that all Canadians became very familiar with in Attawapiskat just more recently. But in terms of being able to do more in Aboriginal community, we'll obviously be working with our affiliates to establish the relationships and the ones that and trying to build Habitat presence in more remote locations in Canada. I think it's going to be our opportunity to do more for Aboriginal families.
And that's completely understandable. And so when will the program roll out and homes will start being built in some of those communities?
Well, as I mentioned, our program's been operating since 2007. It was run as a pilot for 3 years under the sponsorship of the Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation. And we have, in 2010, formalized as a permanent program of Habitat and have assigned staffing resources to it. We know that there's support for our Aboriginal housing program in the corporate community. We have we've been getting some financial support towards it from the Shane Family Foundation, from RBC Foundation, and PCL Construction as well. So I think the fact that we formalized the program is going to be our opportunity to bring more support. Again, I think Canadians want to see more done, and it's through our discussions with the Assembly of First Nations that I think it's going to help show us the path as to being able how to achieve this within the more remote communities. I think what we have fully realized over the three plus years of the pilot program is the fact that it's not a one size fits all. Each community has its own unique needs. And we need to have those discussions and have an opportunity to hear back from the from the leaders of those communities in terms of how Habitat can help them in their in terms of their housing needs. So it's something we're going to continue to work at. Our target right now is to have over 100 homes for Aboriginal families over the next 5 years. I know it's not a might not sound like a big number relative to the need, but what's important about Habitat always is that it's about the permanent change and the transformational impact that home ownership can have within terms of both economic, but in terms of family health, in terms of the dignity of the family, and all the other things that Habitat homeowners enjoy or are able to achieve once they become once they receive their home. So we'll continue, and we're active now in a number of our affiliates in Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and Ontario with regard to Aboriginal families off reserve, and we want to find ways to see our model brought to on reserve, and that's where we're really excited by the prospect of the partnership with the AFN to help establish that.
That was Stuart Hardacre, President and CEO of Habitat for Humanity. Now here's J.C. Campbell with Go Ahead.
Flies high as a butterfly, drifting under morning sun. Way too long I've been gone, striking six strings, finding new things to sing about.
Thompson is an associate professor at the University of Manitoba with the Natural Resource Institute. She's been looking into how the delivery of essential services, including water, housing, waste management, and food security, can be improved in northern communities. Thompson says they've been working with the community of Lake St. Martin First Nation through the relocation efforts.
Well, we are working with Lake St. Martin, which was a community that was displaced. Artificially flooded, and the channel was really put through very close to their community. So we're looking at a planned community that includes food production, sustainable food production, and energy production in its plan, in its land use plan. So I think it's very important to look at the natural resources available to the communities, do a natural resource assessment, and then look at how community economic development can be used to create jobs and housing and sustainable community that meets the needs of the community. For example, Lake St. Martin prioritizes language and culture, like indigenous knowledge systems. So in its land use plan, how to work in language houses and ways to valorize culture and realize that they there have been many barriers and to cultural integrity, and trying to revitalize culture is very important.
And so how does that tie in with sustainability?
By having local food production based on the land, what could best be grown based on the skills of the people and the land, and not necessarily grown, harvested. For example, Leaf Rapids, around Leaf Rapids, they've planted 15,000 berry plants. So this is a very high northern community, and they're looking at collecting berries. So berry gathering, which is a very traditional activity, and that's something some of the Island Lake communities want to pursue as well. So if you can feed yourself, it's a very sustainable community. That's the basis of a good life, is good housing, good foods, good governance, and looking how everything ties together. We have a model that was developed with Merle Ballard. She's a community member of Lake St. Martin for her PhD thesis, and it looks at a community plan that considers the political, so sovereignty, and, like so many communities, it sounds like about 75% of communities are in third-party management, is how to get out of third-party management, to have control over your resources again. So that's another aspect, is having control over the resources by having more direct management. It's so political, it's called PESCI, and it stands for political, economic, social, cultural, and environmental. So considering all those aspects in development and in planning.
And so now does this also promote economic development and jobs?
So that's very important, is not only being able to feed yourself, but to have livelihoods, sustainable livelihoods. So food production can lead to that. Certainly one of the best, the local sources for selling is the school. For example, the schools in Lynn Lake buy the berries from the berry co-op, the community co-op, that are picked in that area. And all year long round, the kids make juice out of it, and it's available for all the school children and all the events. But that could be extended and should be extended to fish. There's many of these communities have great local fish and a very healthy source of food and a way of fighting and reducing diabetes, and wild meat. So there are policy constraints on that. But food security should be a priority, and Canadian food inspection services should prioritize this and not see those limits. So they can provide jobs in the energy field. Geothermal and biomass can employ a lot of people. Biomass is using either local trees or waste wood, or stubble from agriculture in order to burn it and fuel the community.
That was Shirley Thompson, associate professor at the University of Manitoba with the Natural Resource Institute. You've been listening to Bomb Siddell with Jennifer Ashwasagay. Bomb Siddell is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bomb Siddell means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bomseda.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bomb Siddell.